Tony, we've known each other now for the best part of 50 years, and as you look back at it, I wonder, has it turned out the way you hoped it would?
Well, it certainly has, and even better, I think. I remember when I opened up Radio 1, a journalist said to me the day after, he said, you know, what would you like to be doing in 2 years' time? So I thought, well, the programme wasn't that bad. And so, no, it's been absolutely wonderful, better than I'd ever hoped, really, to be honest with you.
And can you remember the very first time that you opened a microphone fader and spoke to the great unwashed outside? Can you recall that moment or what it felt like?
I really can. It's in fact, I didn't open the fader because it was on Radio Caroline and I was sitting in a studio and somebody else in those days opened the fader up. And I remember it was called The Big Lineup. It was July the 25th, 1964, and I played, The Four Seasons and Ragdoll. That's right.
And how did it grow from there? I mean, were you confident at that point? Were you, having been on stage as a performer, a singer, were you ready for that idea of sitting in a room on your own and talking to maybe hundreds of thousands of people? Did it faze you at all?
Do you know, funny enough, Tim, no, it's always been very natural to me to speak into a microphone. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world. It's much easier than going on a stage because when you sit in front of a microphone and talking to an object like a... Well, there's some people, you know, it works for some people, it doesn't. Luckily with me, it did. And, you know, when you go on a stage and you say something, it doesn't get a reaction. Then you think, oh, God, that's awful. But if you go in front of a microphone, you presume that everybody found what you said funny. And so I've always loved that. I've always loved the warmth of a studio. I've always loved it.
And you talk there about enjoying things being funny. I remember the last time I sat down in front of a microphone and interviewed you, and I listened back to it yesterday. One of the things you said was that it's important for DJs to have a style of their own so that even the mere mention of a jock's name would instantly conjure up some sort of audio picture. I'm wondering, did you consciously create a style for Tony Blackburn?
I don't think I did. I mean, the DJ that when I was at school I always admired was Pete Murray. And he used to tell the most appalling jokes. I don't think people remember that. And it's always been my sense of humour, you know, the quick line gags and things like that, which I did. But I don't think I ever particularly modelled myself on anyone. I mean, I loved listening to Alan Freeman in the old days. I thought he was tremendous with chart shows. So whenever I do now the Pick of the Pops in my mind, particularly when I do the chart rundown, I have this image of Alan there. And I always hope that he would like what I'm doing. And it's very modelled on what he did because there's no better way to do a chart rundown. And but I think really when I go on the air, I'm just being me, particularly now that I've got older as well, because my broadcasting now is not the same as it was. I don't tell these gags the whole time. I do tell them, but in a slightly different way.
I remember when we first worked together, you used to have a little series of red notebooks,
yes.
one of which
yes.
you always had in your jacket pocket. And if anybody around us ever said anything, you'd pull yes. this book out and you'd write down what they said. Do you
That's
still
right.
keep a record of funny ideas?
Yeah, I don't actually anymore, no. I think as you get older, life just becomes funny as well around you. And, you know, people let you off with certain things you might have said. But no, I find actually broadcasting easier now than I ever have done. I mean, I've always found it quite easy. And I've always been aware of my image, you know, the cheesy image and things like that. But that's never bothered me particularly. You know, you can't appeal to everybody. And I learnt that way early on in life. You know, you can't. But if you can appeal to, you know, a fair amount of people, and I've always gone, try to go for a mass audience, and you achieve that, you know, then as far as I'm concerned, that's it.
You've always been a little bit self-deprecating about yourself, and indeed you were there. And I'm thinking of things like taking the mickey out of the way you've dressed on stage or about the quality of your jokes. But behind that, surely in order to do what you've done and achieved, there must be a very confident Tony Blackburn behind all that.
You'd be surprised how unconfident I am. It's not as confident as you might think. I mean, I've never had this gigantic ego that some of my, I won't mention any names, have had. And I've never had the ability to say, well, you know, I've always been aware that I can be replaced or anybody can be replaced within, you know, 10 seconds. There's always somebody waiting to take over from you. And so I've always been aware of that and I've always never taken things for granted. And funnily enough, I remember when I left Radio 1 and I went to Radio London. And it was a much smaller outfit and things like that. But the show I was doing there, I was really proud of, so it didn't really bother me too much that it was on a smaller station. So although I've been very ambitious all my career, and I'm terribly glad to be on Radio 2 now, you know, I didn't think that would happen, and doing Pick of the Pops, it's never bothered me too much the fact that I'm on a smaller station or not the main station, as long as the show that I'm doing I consider to be okay, you know, and good, and it's making people, making people tune in. So, but I don't have that gigantic ego that one or two of my friends have got, and particularly on television, I think it was a bit of a shame that, in a way, that I wasn't that confident on TV, because I look back at some of the Top of the Pops. And now I quite like looking back on them because I'm only 30 on there. And I'm now younger than my own son. And I look back on there and I think, actually, I wasn't as bad as I thought I was.
So it's quite interesting because I noticed that this week you're on BBC Four presenting an edition of Top of the Pops from 1978. Mm. Now, will that tempt you to tune in yourself and watch yourself again?
Oh, of course. There's so little good to watch on TV, I wouldn't dare miss myself. I do watch them, yes, I do watch them now and then. Not the whole time, obviously, I do think that, I mean, they're doing very well on BBC Four and it's nice to see them back. And I do enjoy seeing them, yes.
Is there anything about the Tony Blackburn you see there when you look back at yourself in, say, the 70s that you think, wish I hadn't done that?
Some of the clothes, obviously. I don't think so. I don't have... the only regret I have... Somebody asked me this the other day, and they said, if you could look back, do you have any regrets on your career? The only regret I think I probably had was when I was at Radio 1, getting involved too much in the politics. You know, when you're younger, you always think you can do it better than the people that are in charge of you. And so, therefore, probably getting involved in the politics. And one thing I would say to, any younger DJ, don't get involved in the politics of any radio station because, you know, you've accepted a job there and the bosses there who are telling you to do this, do that, even if you might disagree slightly with it, it's probably best to go along with it because the long term you can change their minds occasionally.
For the benefit of those who maybe who work in radio but haven't worked in a big organisation in the way that you have, give us just a clue of what you mean by getting involved in the politics.
Well, I think when you go into a radio station, if there's a format that you've been asked to do and you know very well that perhaps playing the same 300 records over and over again, it could be better than that. But the people involved don't want to hear it, really, because you're there to present the programme and so it's probably best that you just go ahead and do that. I mean, if you're asked what you think, then by all means you can express your opinion. But I think sometimes getting involved in the politics, we've all got our own job to play. And I think as a broadcaster, as a disc jockey, if you accept the job, then you're accepting it on the terms of the radio station. If you don't like it, then don't accept it and go somewhere else. So I think probably it's taken me probably about 30 years to learn that. But I think probably in the early days of Radio 1, when I was very much younger, I could have probably kept my mouth shut in certain areas. Yeah.
You're happily ensconced and obviously thoroughly enjoying working for the nation's largest network,
yes,
BBC Radio 2 at the moment. But you said something there which raises a question. You said maybe you might think that playing the same 300 records all the time is a problem. Does that suggest that you would find it difficult to work for a commercial station now, where some commercial stations are rotating many fewer than 300 discs?
Mm. Well, I wouldn't find it difficult if I accepted that job. Luckily, the two commercial radio stations I work for, I select my own music. Now, so that's terrific. I would certainly accept a job working on that radio station, but I do question the very limited playlist that a lot of the commercial stations particularly have. And to me, it doesn't quite make sense, you know, because there's the BBC that don't have these very small playlists and they're doing better. So if I was running a commercial radio station, I'd think to myself, well, perhaps they're doing something that's right. And if I was running a commercial radio station, then I would actually free the playlists up and probably encourage the broadcasters on there to have a personality. Because I do find that most of the commercial radio stations I listen to, I'm talking about the music ones, they don't have much personality. And I think that's a shame because you've got to bring on personality to attract audiences. That's my view at any rate. I mean, some people say no, they're just listening for the, just the music and it becomes background. But if you become a background station with a big audience, if you're selling commercials, surely people aren't hearing the commercials.
Picking up on something you said there, there's quite a lot goes on in the politicking side of the industry today, in which the commercial sector fairly regularly objects to the kind of music that Radio 2 in particular plays and suggests that that is perhaps limiting commercial radio's ability to garner an even larger audience. I wonder whether you feel that it is the fact that Radio 2 might be playing similar music to commercial radio that means that commercial radio doesn't do as well as Radio 2, or does it have something to do with the level of presentation?
I think the reason why commercial radio is not doing as well as it should do is because it's quite badly run in a lot of aspects. I think really commercial radio should, up until fairly recently, they limit the amount of speech that a DJ can do, and they also limit their playlists, and it's not working. So therefore, if I was running a commercial radio station, I would say, what's Radio 2 doing that we're not doing? Now, granted, Radio 2 can pay more money, and they've got they can pay more money for good presenters, but I don't understand why commercial radio stations can't actually broaden out their playlists and also encourage young broadcasters to come into the industry and have a personality. I think they have killed off the personality, and I think that's a tragedy for the radio business. I can't believe, for instance, there aren't a few Kenny Everetts and Dave Cashes and people like that around nowadays as there were in the 60s when I started.
You had all those years when you started on the BBC, and you came to that, and you've spoken about it often in your books and in interviews, about how your great love was American radio and commercial radio, and the excitement that commercials bring to, if you like, the unleavened bread of straight editorial. I wonder, therefore, when you moved from the world of BBC radio to commercial radio for the first time, did that feel like a breath of fresh air?
It did. I mean, I've always had a deep love for the BBC. I always have. You know, right from the word go, I think the BBC, to work there, is very special. I love the BBC because it gives you more freedom, funnily enough. But I did enjoy very much indeed when I went to commercial radio for the first time. It was just something totally different. It was a breath of fresh air. There weren't so many radio stations on as well. And when I went to America and heard American radio, I was very excited by it, and I loved the commercials. And in the 60s, as with the jingles, I think there was more creativity in the commercials than there are now. The commercials became a part of it. I remember, start your day with Weetabix and Bulova Watch Time and all that sort of stuff in the 60s was great. Now I don't think it's quite so exciting. I also do blame, to a very large extent, the radio, the powers that be in this country for allowing too many radio stations to broadcast in this country. I think it's ridiculous. In America, there's a bigger audience. But over here, they've killed it off by licensing too many radio stations. Now, I never thought I would say that, but it's absolutely true. And also, the stupidity of not having what I consider to be one of the... This is an ageing population, and we still don't have an oldie station on an FM frequency. Now, why on earth is that? I mean, that to me is the most ridiculous thing, and I
blame the authorities. We have oldie stations on DAB frequencies.
Well, DAB, yes. I mean, there are oldie stations on DAB, but still, nevertheless, in most, you look at a traffic jam and you think most people can't hear it on DAB. Unfortunately, it hasn't taken off the way it should have done because the car firms haven't put the DAB radios in. I mean, it might be for the future, but I can't understand why a station like Gold or Capital Gold or Classic Gold never got an FM frequency. To me, that is ridiculous.
Well, for those of us actually in this business, we do know, I think we're well aware just how consistently you've been broadcasting over these last 4 or 5 decades. But for the public at large, there have been periods where you kind of slipped out of the national consciousness. And I just wondered how those periods felt, particularly after starting with that massive adulation almost when you were on Radio 1.
Well, yes, I mean, when I left Radio 1, at one time I was doing the children's show on Radio 1, which I'll be absolutely honest with you, I didn't really enjoy doing so much because of the Puff the Magic Dragon and all those sort of things, sparking the talking piano, didn't quite do it for me. Whereas I was on Radio London doing a soul show, and I really, really enjoyed that. I think probably out of all the shows I've done over the years, that was the best show I've ever done. And so it didn't bother me as much as it other people thought it did. I remember going to Radio London, having come from Radio 1, and there was a lovely producer I worked with called Cheryl Garnsey. And I remember she didn't really want to work with me in the initial stages because she was working with Robbie Vincent. And she said to me, right, I'm going to bring you back. And I said, what do you mean, bring you back? He says, well, you don't seem to have realised how low you've gone. I said, you were working at Radio 1. He said, now you're here. And so, and she said, well, we'll do a damn good programme together. And she did bring it. She, first of all, made me realise that I wasn't any longer at the top of the tree, which I hadn't really thought about. And it didn't bother me as much as it bothered her or other people, because I was doing a show that I really loved. In other words, playing soul music. And because I don't think people realise, you know, I've got this cheesy image and things like that, but I don't think people realised how much I love music, and particularly black soul music. And so, therefore, I was doing 3 hours every morning broadcasting to London, doing the music that I loved. And it didn't bother me so much that I wasn't on national radio.
But you'd come through a period where your first marriage had tragically had broken up.
Yep.
And then you were into this period where you weren't on Radio 1, and an awful lot of the requests to appear on television, for instance, or be interviewed in magazines started to fall away. Mm. You must have, I mean, although you would have enjoyed your radio show, there must have been something in you that said, you know, is this the beginning of the end of my career? Yeah. Am I going to have to open a pub or do something else? Didn't those thoughts cross your mind?
No. Funnily enough, they honestly didn't, Tim. I've never thought like that. You know, it didn't. I mean, I was aware that I wasn't on national radio anymore, but I thought, well, what I'm doing here in London is a darn sight better than what I was doing on Radio 1 on the children's show, although people tell me that they actually enjoyed that show. But having said that, I wasn't enjoying it. I loved Radio 1 and the daily shows I did, but the children's show didn't really do it for me, you know. But what I was doing on Radio London, I really loved. And we were having a lot of success with it as well, with the Soul Nights Out and things like that. And so it didn't bother me as much as it should have done, probably. And I wasn't quite aware.
Was there any sense in which that shift into a dedicated soul show was a deliberate attempt to put the kind of razzmatazz of Radio 1 behind you?
No, it was just a stroke of luck. I mean, when I went to Radio London originally, I was doing the most appalling show in the afternoon. It was the usual sort of local radio thing where somebody would come in and plug a book, and it was a really boring show. And I went out to dinner with Derek Amor, who was quite a character, which you probably remember. And we went out to dinner together, and he said he wanted me to do a show called BBC Blackburn Barnes and Company with a very nice girl called Susie Barnes.
Yes.
And I said to him, I said, I like Susie very much, but I said, I think it's a really appalling idea. And I said, I'm going to have to resign. And he said to me, don't resign. I said, why not? He said, I don't want you to resign. I said, OK, I won't resign. He said, OK, you haven't resigned. He said, all right, I'll sack you then. And I said, you can't do that. And we'd had a few glasses of wine by this time. And he said, at the end of the evening, I think I'd been fired by him 3 or 4 times and I'd resigned. And he said, what on earth do you want to do? I said, I would love to do an over-the-top soul show. And he said, what a great idea. And he said, this was on a Friday, he said, when can you start? I said, when do you want me to start? He said, Monday. And I said, the idea I've got, it, putting it out at 9 o'clock in the morning, I said, I was wanting to make it more over the top than that. And anyhow, he said, no, it's all right. He said, we'll call it an X-rated show and you'd do that. And and so we did the show and it was enormously successful. And I remember I was doing the children's show at the same time. And there was a call from Derek Chinnery, the head of Radio 1, to Derek Amor and said, can you please stop Tony Blackburn talking about stockings and suspenders on the radio? And Derek Amor said, we're not bothered about him talking about them. We're just trying to stop him wearing them. And I thought, that is the end of me doing the children's show. And I think about 3 months later, that was it.
How did they tell you that was coming to an end, that children's show? Can you remember the meeting?
The way I found out, actually, was I went into the BBC and a commissioner said to me, he said, we are going to miss you, Tony. And I had no idea. And that's the way I found out from the commissioner. But that was it. The contract wasn't. And quite right, you know, I'd been there 17 years and I think that was enough, really. I was getting older. I wanted to go on to Radio 2. That was the whole idea. But, of course, you know, there was lovely Doreen Davis and there was Derek...
Teddy Warwick?
No, Doreen's husband.
Derek Mills.
Derek Mills. How could I forget Derek Mills? And, of course, husband and wife. So I couldn't very well, behind the scenes, go to Derek Mills and say I would love to work at Radio 2 because presumably he might have gone to Doreen and said, you know, Tony doesn't want to be on your station anymore and there might not have been a job at Radio 2. But I knew it was time to go from Radio 1 because I was getting older.
OK, well, you're now at Radio 2, as yes. we've recognised, but I also, from time to time, hear you on a BBC local station.
Yeah.
Broadcasting, I think, out of Reading or somewhere there.
Caversham, yes.
Caversham.
Right. Yes. BBC Radio Berkshire.
And when I hear that, I hope you agree, I hear a very different Tony Blackburn.
Oh, yes, totally.
So
yes.
Tell me something why, after your initial, all those years ago, concern about what local radio was doing, you're now happy to embrace it.
Well, I was asked by John Bache, actually, who, of course, I've worked for over the years. And John said to me, would you like to come and do fill in for Anne Diamond for a week? And I said, that would be great. And it was a chat show and music and things like that. And I said, great. And then they offered me a show there, five-day-a-week show, actually, eventually. And I said, that's probably too much because I'm working for five radio stations. And I didn't want to do 7 days a week. And I said, well, if you could find me one show a week, that would be great. And Anne only wanted to do 4 days. So I now do the Fridays there. And I've managed to alter the show. We've managed to alter the show a little bit now. And it's a bit of a, you know, more of a fun show than it was as well. But I love the challenge of it. It's more speech. And I love speech radio.
And if there's a big story breaks, do you find that you have to do some interviews that aren't necessarily about fun?
Occasionally, yes. Occasionally we do. But I've interviewed politicians and things like that because I am quite political. I mean, I do tend to watch news channels a lot and things like that. I'm not the sort of inane sort of person that a lot of people might think I am, you know.
How do you... I mean, I can speak with feeling about that because I remember you getting into trouble broadcasting back on The Breakfast Show at Radio 1 in the 60s because you decided on air to have a go at the TUC at a time when they were quite powerful.
Yes,
and I just wonder, so have you learned over the years perhaps to curb your own personal political feelings?
I have to curb it more now. I mean, at BBC Berkshire, BBC Radio Berkshire, I can... you know, if I'm interviewing somebody from the TUC or it might be a politician, it's different because they've got the right of reply. Where I have to, I don't think it's a good thing for a broadcaster to tell everybody which side he supports or anything like that. I've never done that. I have to curb my opinions on Twitter more than anything else now because Twitter and Facebook, you've got to be a little bit careful on there. And I think a lot of people get into trouble because they don't realise it is the same as broadcasting. You know, if you tweet a message, then it's out there. So I have to be careful with that, and I try not to... I'm not a great lover of, TUCs and things like that and unions and things. And some of the stuff that they do annoy me a little bit, but I keep it to myself now.
OK.
You become terribly sensible.
Well, this is good. Those 40 years have actually taken you into another place, which is good. You mentioned John Bache there, and you've worked for so many different bosses at the BBC and in commercial radio. And I'm thinking of people like not only John Bache, but John Simons, Richard Park.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, what are your expectations of a boss when you're working for a radio station? And how often have those expectations been met?
Well, I like somebody... if I'm absolutely honest, it leaves me alone to get on with it. Because I think after all these time, I know what the public wants from me, at any rate. And most of the bosses now, I think it's after the time, they are hiring me, they're hiring a Tony Blackburn, you know. They know what I do and, you know, I can't change now and I don't particularly want to change. I will change to fit in formats, but I think a boss that, you know, leaves me alone. I'm very lucky I work with some good producers now. I've got a really good producer down in BBC Berkshire called John Hudson. Cheryl Garnsey was a terrific producer that I worked with. So, and of course, on Pick of the Pops, I'm working with my old friend who I've known for 48, 49 years now, Phil Swern, who knows everything there is to know about music. So he produces the show, you know, he gets all the music together and everything, and he lets me put my own personality. I mean, Bob Shannon, when he offered me Pick of the Pop, said that there are two Tony Blackburns. There's the cheesy one, and there's the music one. He said, I really want the music one. And the other day I said to him, I said, have you noticed the fact you're getting a mixture of both? And he said, well, it's working really well. So, so that's it. I can't stop the cheesy part, I mean, or the commercial part coming out of me, you know. It's one of those things, because I don't think, even if it's a chart show, I think it's very important to get the information across, which Phil gives me. But at the same time, it's not the Bible, it's not religion, it's fun, and it is an entertainment programme. And luckily it's worked, because, you know, the ratings are very high on it now, which is lovely.
Yeah, I mean, this week's ratings show you at the highest level ever, so congratulations
Thank
on that.
Thank you very much.
You made reference to your producers there. I mean, I am aware there'll be a lot of our colleagues in the industry listening to us now who perhaps have never worked one-on-one with a producer, perhaps much more used to a kind of a general supervision by a programme director or a controller, and some of those complain that they hardly ever hear anything from their bosses.
Yeah.
But tell me how that relationship between a producer actually in the studio with you and you works. What does a producer bring to the team?
Well, I think if you take, it's very different with Pick of the Pops. You've got Phil does, he's already given me the charts. He's given me all the timings and all the information about the music and things like that. So it's up to me to to do the chart rundown, which I remember when I got the job, of course, you, Tim, said to me it would be a good idea to come in and rehearse the programme. And I sort of arrogantly said, I think that'd be all right. And I remember in this very studio that we're in, trying to do the chart rundown, and I couldn't do it. And you said to me, it's like riding a bike. You know, once you've done it and you've got the timings right, it is like riding a bike and you can do it. And you were quite right. I mean, I remember taking the music home with me, that lovely Pick of the Pops chart rundown, and rehearsing it for a good hour and a half or so. And I remember getting it right for the first time and thinking, oh, God, that's great. And from that moment on, I could do it. So therefore, with Phil, he's the other side of the glass and he does all the timings, because the timings are just so important on Pick of the Pops, and having somebody there doing the timings. And also we have a good fun with the show as well. I mean, Pick of the Pops is a great team effort and it's a lot of fun. But with a producer on, say, BBC Radio Berkshire, John, he gets the show together, he gets the guests together, and he's a lot younger, as most people are, than me now. And he comes up with things, you know, would it be a good idea to do that? Would it be a good idea? And you, after all these years, you can still learn from people. And I think it's very good to have somebody like that.
When I was producing Alan Freeman, which I did for many, many, many years, I got to learn that if at any time he looked up from his microphone or his notes and saw me not looking at him and attentively listening, he used to panic and put the reverse talkback on and say, am I doing all right? Am I doing all right? And part of my job as a producer there was to build up his insecurity.
Yes, I mean, of course.
Is there any kind of banter like that between you and a producer?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. I mean, if during Pick of the Pops I crack what I consider to be something funny, it's the producer's job to laugh. Because if you said something that's moderately amusing, what you think's amusing, and you're getting no reaction at all, it isn't a good thing. I think it's, you know, so therefore, I mean, I remember Graham Norton's producer, lovely guy, said, my job, I sit here and just laugh at him and he's very happy. But it's a combination. I mean, I think when you go on the air, it's very important to create a fun atmosphere. You know, I've always thought at a radio station, one of the jobs of somebody who's running a radio station is to create a nice, fun atmosphere. I've worked for one or two radio stations where it isn't like that, and it's all negative. I think positive is good, because if people are positive and you're congratulated sometimes, and this was what a lot of people, bosses, don't do, they don't say well done for things. And, you know, just having somebody say well done for something, it means so much to a broadcaster. And then you can take the negatives. Then when something comes along and you haven't done it correctly, then you'll take it on board. Whereas if it's all negative, then you just don't take any notice of it anymore. I've never understood one or two people, names not mentioned, they know who they are probably, but it's very important to encourage the broadcaster, you know.
When we started out, you were 25, I was 24, yes. And I remember on one of our very first meetings, you said to me, Tim, we are going to be fun pioneers.
Yes.
And it seems to me that over the years you have been fun pioneers, but in your latest book, you talk quite openly about your struggles from time to time with stress and occasional depression, yet every time you seem to come back as if there's been no handicap, as if there've been no hurdles. What is the Tony Blackburn secret that's enabled you to do that over so many years?
It's the love of broadcasting. I mean, I could quite happily live in a radio studio, to be honest with you. I just love the media. I think it's just so special. And I think sometimes you hear some of the younger DJs whinging about the fact, oh, you know, I've been up all this, the hours and things like that, and I'm doing this, that and the other. It's a privilege to be broadcasting, and I've never lost that. You know, I just love the music. I love what I'm doing. And the fact now that, you know, with, say, Pick of the Pops, it's getting the biggest audience ever, is a terrific thrill to me. You know, I don't think people realise. So therefore, that's the reason. I mean, life is up. It has its ups and downs. Yeah, I've had my really bad times, and then you come out of it and you suddenly realise what you're doing is terrific. I think I made probably the biggest mistake was when my marriage went wrong first time round, and I was talking about it too much. I was encouraged a little bit to talk about it, you know, and to some people it was thing, but I did bore the country, for, you know, stupid for a long time, and that was, it got to me a little bit, and I learned from that not to. I do like to bring my personal life into it to a certain extent. You know, I do talk about my children and my wife and things like that because it makes you a human being. But I think if something goes wrong, then people don't want to hear that. You know, certainly don't want to hear that. They've got enough troubles of their own, particularly nowadays, you know, with the recession. And I just, you know, after all this time, I'm just very, very lucky to be doing what I'm doing. And particularly, I mean, it was a icing on top of the cake to get Pick of the Pops, to be honest with you. I mean, I was working for Smooth Radio at the time, which I liked very much. But when Bob Shannon said, you know, would you like to do Pick of the Pops, unfortunately you can't work for both stations. I thought about it for about 3 seconds, and as much as I love Smooth Radio, Pick of the Pops was special, and you know, that was an icing on the cake. I didn't think I would ever get on Radio 2. You know, it took them 30 years to discover me, and so that to me has actually, for the, you know, these remaining sort of times of my broadcasting career, that one moment was something that was very special to me. And Pick of the Pops, and particularly working with your best friend on it as well, very special.
Tony Blackman, thank you very much for spending time with us. I'd also like to thank Unique Facilities for hosting this particular edition. But from me, Tim Blackmore, and my guest, Tony Blackburn, bye-bye for now.